Bring the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. Let's see, the minutes. Representative Dill, would you care to move the minutes?
Yep.
Representative Dill moves the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. A number of bills to get through today, members. We're going to come back later this evening. 615 and 300 South. Hope to get through everything except the game and fish bill. We will do the game and fish bill tonight starting at 6:15. Hopefully we can get through the rest of the agenda before we have to come back tonight. So with that, Representative Lewick moves House File 1186. Representative Lewick, where does the bill have to go next?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the hearing. It would go to Jobs, Growth, Energy, and Affordability Policy
Committee. That is your motion?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. 1186, some would say it's a technical adjustment. What we've got is a situation where technology may, in some cases, have overtaken specific things within the trades. This would provide a specific company, U.S. Steel, with a situation that's very similar to our co-ops out there, our electrical power companies. My background, naval shipyards, even at the county level, they would have the opportunity with the bargaining unit that's involved with that particular company to have some flexibility in how they qualify, their technical people, and how they'd be treated under the regulations we have for a variety of things. In particular, one will come to mind, and we'll hear testimony on, I'm sure, on licensing electricians. What I'd like to do, we've got some experts on this that I'd like to turn it over for testimony here that can give you a little more detail. I guess Mr. Peter Coyle would like to start it off.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Coyle of Larkin Hoffman, and I represent United States Steel. I'm going to be joined in the testimony today by Dan Pierce, who's the president of USW Local 2660, and also by John Scooby, who's the general manager of human relations for U.S. Steel up on the range. Just as a premise to the bill, members and Mr. Chairman, the bill is applicable broadly to the mining industry. It's not specific to one company. I want to make sure you're clear about that. And secondly, what we're attempting to do by the bill is to try to align the regulatory structure for electricians and electrical services that are provided within mining companies to an exemption that already exists in law for the inspections of that work. And all the inspections are handled through the federal government, through the Mine Safety Administration. The licensing process for electricians, though, is still handled through the state of Minnesota. The second point, then, is there are a number of exemptions to the licensing statute that are already established in statute, starting with, for example, utility companies. So this is not a unique concept that we're proposing today, but it really patterns itself on other exemptions that have been granted. And then thirdly, the language that's before you today was vetted with the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm not aware that they have any opposition to the language, and to the contrary, they've indicated that the language is acceptable to them. So I just offer that to you. And with that, Dan, do you want to go ahead?
Dan Pierce. good afternoon. My name is Dan Pierce. I'm a steel worker from United Tech, or Keewatin Taconite, and I'm also the president. I'm here today in support of our electrical members. The mining company has been exempt from these inspections for over 120 years. As you all know, that we also do have MSHA come in twice a year, and they're there for multiple months per their inspections. They have full support of our local and the company. They have authorization to inspect any areas on the property as they seem fit. We also do have the county inspectors also coming in and doing their inspections to look at our facility also. And we also have our own members and management doing inspections in areas to make sure everyone is safe. The USW and US Steel work together to ensure our electrical workers are safe. Each year, we send our electrical members to the National Electric Code class. That is basically a class that gets all our electricians up to speed on new codes or existing codes that may have changed. So each one of our electricians at both facilities go to that class. The company encourages our members to get their license for journeyman and master electricians status by providing the training at no extra cost to the employee. Each member has his or her own hours signed off and sent into the state. As a union president and a member of the USW, I'd like to see this practice continue for the next 20 years. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is John Scooby. I'm the Director of Human Resources for U.S. Steel's Minnesota Aurora Operations in northeastern Minnesota.
Please proceed.
Chairman Hackberg, thank you for the opportunity to present these important points. This particular change in the statute is important to U.S. Steel. Mining companies, like my colleague Dan mentioned, since 1990 have enjoyed an exemption from inspections with respect to the electrical statutes. Like Dan was saying, the MSHA, Mine Safety and Health Administration, is on our property the majority of the year inspecting our work, inspecting the safety of our facilities, along with the county mine inspector. There's no doubt that we do the electric work safely and the way it's supposed to be done. The state licensing requirements that are presently in the statute that it insists that the company be registered as a electrical employer. In addition, all electrical workers are required to be registered as unlicensed, at least as unlicensed electricians. This triggers a degree of administration oversight that is unrealistic in our industry. Fulfilling those statute requirements is very difficult and challenging given the large footprint of our operation. We have three huge plant buildings, over 150 electricians at Minnesota Ore, and the supervisory requirements and the requirements that this present statute requires that is very cumbersome and is very challenging. Mr. Coyle said, a number of industries have already received exemptions from this language, in particular the utilities industry. There should be no question as far as U.S. Steel's commitment to safety. Both the steelworkers and U.S. Steel have been totally committed to safety. It would never put anything in the way of returning our employees safely to home. Before we even agreed to venture towards getting this adjustment made to the statute, this local steelworker union and the company made a pretty impressive agreement. Number one, first recognizing that having master electricians and journeyman electricians license on the property was a good thing, and both the company and the union support that wholeheartedly. In addition, the company has verified has committed to verify those hours worked by our electricians so as to qualify them for license status, whether it be journeyman, whether it be a master status, if those employees would wish to go on and become licensed. In addition, we've agreed to reimburse any test fees or registration fees that the employees would be faced with to become licensed. And finally, like Dan had mentioned, we already offer electric code classes, and we had agreed with the union contingent upon all this this legislation hopefully going through, that we would continue offering that type of education and training to our employees. We think this would be a good, healthy change to the existing statute. And by the way, I just wanted to mention that we have also been negotiating with IBEW to iron out any differences we may have in the proposed language. Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes our testimony. We'd be happy to take questions if you have any for us at this time.
Very good. At this time, we'll take Representative Lewick's amendment to get the bill in the shape that he'd like, the H-1186-A1. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Anything else, Representative Lewick, before we take testimony or questions from the members?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Questions, members? Testimony. Seeing no questions, any anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill as amended? Please come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Haney, Legislative Director for IBEW Minnesota State Council. We first became aware of the bill, we looked at it and we had a number of concerns with it. Felt it was somewhat overreaching for what they were trying to do. Had several discussions since that time with talked to the author and talked to some other legislators on it, and a couple of times with U.S. Steel as well, and we will continue to do that. We're not here to oppose the bill. We're just here to let you know that we're very concerned about it, as are the union contractors with National Electrical Association, as well as the non-union electrical contractors with Minnesota Electrical Association. We'll hopefully work out the issues we have with it before the next meeting. If not, then we'll have to decide on what course we're going to take. I just want to highlight a couple things for you. Our big concern is to maintain the integrity that exists in statute today for of the electrician's license. There's a process there that people are to follow to get that license, and you can go through an accredited apprenticeship program for 4 years and meet the requirements that way. I know that the utility exemption from licensing was mentioned, but they also have an accredited apprenticeship program there. The once a person is licensed, whether they go through one of our programs, get their experience at the mine, and they're hours certified, sit for the exam, pass the exam, they can go work anywhere, including your house. And you want to be sure that once a person is a licensed electrician, they really know what they're doing. They passed the test, but they've retained all that they've learned about electrical theory and about the hands-on of how to do things. The testifiers were from one company and talked about what they will do or are doing, and what they've worked out with Steelworkers Local up there. The bill applies to all companies, and I don't know what their commitments are to their workers, whether there's some with contracts, some without, and what those companies will do on training and whatnot as well. But we'll keep you posted, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Urusso, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one engineer asking a question about another engineer field. Are electrical engineers generally allowed to do electrical work that otherwise electricians do?
They're not generally allowed to know they've.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Urisla.
For instance, chemical engineers know a lot about plumbing, but I wouldn't be allowed to go and do plumbing in people's houses, because what I don't know is the how to do it right, you know, on the joints and all of that. Okay, I know how to do lots of calculations and everything, so I have a similar concern about this, and that's why I'm asking. So I don't know. I'm sure. I don't know where the phrase came from and everything, so I don't know the background on why it says the work certified by a master electrician or an electrical engineer. So that's what I'm curious about there. So I'd like some information about whether that's generally acceptable. Not saying it's not. Raise the question.
Mr. Coyle may be able to answer
that specifically.
Mr. Coyle?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a great question. In statute currently, electrical engineers are allowed to vouch for the work that's performed by people on their staff who are doing electrical work. This bill would not change that. In fact, we're trying to preserve the ability for the employees of a mining company to be licensed and have their time certified by either the master or, if they have an electrical engineer on staff, that person. And the delete all narrowed the scope of the original bill to clarify that it was only those two people. Thank you.
Representative Urisla.
That's all. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Enzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, please don't miss what the intent of this language is. Mining companies are signatory with the United Steelworkers of America, an industrial union. The mine where the steelworkers work is the employer. And terms and conditions of employment and pay grades are established by the bargaining unit. And the position of electrician is usually the highest pay grade in the mine. And those are workers employed by the employer who perform electrical work, who are trained to do electrical work, whose work is overseen and managed and directed by a master electrician. Now, those work rules, in varying degrees from mine to mine, allow certain functions, certain work duties to be performed by contractors who are not employees of the mining company. And these electrical contractors are always signatory to the IBEW. And those workers perform major electrical functions at the mine that the company chooses to contract for. What we're doing here is, in my view, is solidifying, firming up, clarifying what is permissible in Minnesota for an industrial union and their employer. The question of inspections and safety keeps coming up. And I can assure members that whether it's the mine inspector program that has been in place with Iron Range counties for over 75 years, or if it's the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, there is more than adequate inspection of the work in a healthy way. So I just want to caution members not to make this a more complicated issue than it needs to be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, just in response, we're not raising inspection at all, and haven't. I think that your statements, Representative, on the oversight by Masters on the property may be a little off, but that's not what we're talking about here today either. We're hoping we can resolve things so that the individuals involved can get their hours certified and sit for the exam. What we did raise as some concerns were just to maintain the integrity of the training and the process that people go through to become eligible to sit for the exam, so once should they pass their license, that you and I can have confidence in their work, in our hopes, and that's really, really, really important. That's it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're not talking about residential electrical work. We're talking about the function of performing electrical work, most often maintenance, in an industrial setting.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are talking about residential work. A person working at the mine, once they're a licensed electrician, they get laid off, they quit, get fired, whatever, can take that license, it's a shingle, and they can go out and work for an electrical contractor that you or I may contact and have work done in our home. So we're not talking about, while they're working for the mining company, but if they leave there, and people change jobs a lot, and that's one of the reasons why we feel it's so important to maintain the integrity of the license and the experience. The work with the bill, the work that would be allowed, at the mining company is any work, that's covered by the federal exemption. The word, what was that word? Incidental in the bill is, to me, it's a very broad word, and we're trying to work with the company to tie it back to the federal statute so that it only applies, to the parts of the mine that are covered by their exemption. So.
Representative Ansel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Members, I've got five more members that would like to speak to this issue. It is a very important issue, but we've got a number of bills to get through, some controversial issues to get done. We're going to be back tonight again. I don't want to come back here tomorrow night or Friday or any night next week, but we can. We have to. Representative McNamara. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not a question, just a brief comment. I appreciate that IBEW and the companies and the steelworkers are all working together in good faith to find some common ground on this language, and I do plan to support it today, and I hope we can pass it out of committee. In doing that, though, knowing that you're going to continue to work together to try to meet some middle ground, so I do appreciate that you're continuing the conversations. Thank you.
Great comments. Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to Representative Russo's comments, and Mr. Haney, you made some statements about electrical engineering. I just want to be sure. I thought that if you had an electrical engineering degree, that had some credence in your electrical license and or your master electrician. And I thought even when you did phone a friend, you said that was not true. That's not the way I remember it. And I just want to know, because we're using an electrical engineer here. I'm just hopeful that as this moves forward, we could clarify. I thought there was a role that an electrical engineering degree played in electrician and master electrician determination.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the use here, I believe, is consistent with current statute, and I believe that electrical engineer is used throughout the statute in that way for for this purpose or for contractor license and that sort of thing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Haney, I just wanted to clarify, because I thought in your answer to Representative Urusso, you said no, there's no standing for electrical engineer. They'd be just like a person off the street starting. Maybe I misunderstood what you said.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, Representative, is that they aren't allowed, they aren't covered to do the wiring, but, you know, which is what Representative Urusso's point was.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Urusso. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, a question I have is going back to the, a little bit to the testing of the electrician. The work that these individuals would do in the mine would probably be more than likely be different than in a residential, the way I understand it. But they're still getting knowledge on electrical work and doing that, and doing some of the work and being overseen by master electricians to make sure the work is done properly. But if these individuals want to continue their training and take their test to be a licensed electrician, would these people be taking the same test as everybody else, or is there a separate test for industrial and a separate test for residential?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's all the same test.
So, Mr. Chair, so in other words, in order to pass this test, they would need to know that stuff ahead of time. So if they were going to go out and do residential work, if they choose to leave, they would have the knowledge to pass the test just like anybody else.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to point out that, you know, we have written tests, but in trades like this, we don't rely on book learning alone, and so that's why the certification of ours is important. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Seeing none, Representative Lewick renews his motion that House File 1186 be re-referred to the Committee on
Jobs, Growth, Energy, Affordability, Policy,
that's his
and
motion.
Finance Committee.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Votes opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The bill
Chair.
Is passed on. Thank you very much. Representative McNamara. Representative McNamara moves House File 1329. Representative McNamara, we're going to refer this to your committee. Environment, Policy, and Finance.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my motion would be to move House File 1329 to the House Environment Policy Finance Committee.
That would be your motion, and to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative McNamara, to your bill, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like Assistant Commissioner Meyer to walk through the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. House File 1329, with the delete all amendment, is the department's policy and technical bill. We have taken out several provisions in this bill, and you'll be seeing them tonight in a delete all amendment on the game and fish bill, to expedite another hearing on this bill for state and local government dealing with rulemaking. Most of the issues in this bill are fairly non-controversial and a lot of consensus. There's also some amendments in the DE that we've been working with members on, Representative Lewick, Representative Dill, and other folks, to address some of the concerns in their districts. Going through the DE, Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to try to go through this relatively quickly. If we have specific questions, I do have staff in the audience to answer those questions. So sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill make a change, and actually sections 1, 2, and 3 make a change requiring the purchaser of an ATV or a snowmobile to be required for the transferring of the title rather than the seller. So you'll see the language basically on 1.11, it says the purchaser is subject to penalties if they don't transfer the ownership. Currently, if you sell an ATV or a snowmobile, the onus is on you to have that title transferred. It's we want it to be like votes and cars and everything else like that. So that's the first three sections of the bill. Sections 4, 5, 6 deal with some conversations that we've had over the interim with the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of America, Polaris, of Minnesota, I should say, Polaris, Yamaha, Bombardier, other stakeholder groups dealing with ATVs. It deals with clarification of the definitions of these machines as we move forward. You can see the Class 1 now, rather than a weight, we've been changing these weights for the past decade as these machines evolve and they sell different types of machines to people. So a Class 1 machine will actually be 50 inches of width or less, and a Class 2 will be 65 or more. Section 5 of the bill says a Class 1 ATV is 50 inches or less from outside rim to outside rim. Section 6 says a Class 2 ATV is 50 inches but less than 65. There's also language in this bill that will allow these Class 1 machines that now, that were Class 2 machines that now will become in the Class 1 category to be used on the unimproved roadsides as they were Class 2 machines previously. So Section 8, Representative Moline, I know there were some constituents in your district that had bought these new machines with a roll cage and a steering wheel thinking that they could ride them. Oh, Representative Metz's district, I'm sorry. Up in the northern part of the state, bought these machines thinking that they could ride them on the unimproved shoulder of the road, only to find out that they couldn't. We weren't enforcing that law, but now this clarifies that they can do that. Let me just step back here. Subdivision 4, Section 7 on the top of that page deals with that ATV language on the transfer. Section 8 I covered, talking about the right-of-way use. That carries on to the bottom, to most of page 9, page 4, I should say. Section 9 of the bill and several sections that follow are technical corrections that deal with invasive species. Rather than going from listed, we're changing to a designated process. We did this last year, last session, so that the commission may designate invasive prohibited water bodies rather than list, so infested water bodies, I should say. So now we're picking up some sections of statute that we missed through that process. So rather than go through a formal listing process, we'll designate a water body as an infested water body, post it within the state register, and then this just conforms statute to deal with that process. That does carry on to page 6 and to the top of page 7. Section 15, members, provides the DNR authority that we're clarifying that we have this authority as we're doing decontamination inspections at our wayside checks and at boat ramps and things like that as delegated authorities, counties who have entered into delegated agreements with us, that we do have the authority to require decontamination, including hot water or high-pressure equipment when available, for water-related equipment transported or before it is placed into waters of the state. So basically, this would give us the authority to require a person to have their boat decontaminated before they launch it if it was deemed that it was a contaminated vessel or dock, something like that. On 7.22 to 7.27, it's also giving us the authority to tag this equipment, and you can see it 7.24 or 7.23, an order for removal of prohibited invasive species under paragraph A, clause 1, or decontamination of water-related equipment under paragraph A, clause 5, may include tagging the water-related equipment and issuing a notice that specifies a time frame for completing the removal or decontamination and reinspection of the water-related equipment. So this would give us the authority to adhere a tag to the vessel, make sure that, give them a schedule where they could get their watercraft or water-related equipment decontaminated and how to get that reinspected. Moving on, Section 16 deals with that section again, talking about decontamination. Section 17 and 18 again change the listing to designating. Section 19 allows us to use invasive species funds to also do habitat improvements. If there's a healthy habitat in the lake, there's less likelihood of invasive plants taking hold. So if we have a native plant community in the lake rather than a non-native plant community, those invasives won't be able to spread as quickly. So that's what we're talking about doing there. Section 20 is some language that was brought to us from the Parks and Trails Council that we support that clarifies that This is actually in the outdoor recreation, the state park statutes. It clarifies that if a trail is going by a state park, they may include connections to state park or recreation areas that generally lie in or between the vicinity. So we wouldn't have to come back in and seek separate authorization to provide a spur trail to, say, Bearhead Island State Park or Lake Vermilion or Cuyuna Country Rec Area, things like that. Section 21 is actually an amendment that we worked with Representative Lewick on, stating that the Camp Ripley Veterans Trail may be separated, have a separate grade for motorized and non-motorized if needed. So as acceptable as needed, there's some portions of the path that that's needed. Section 22 clarifies that when we combine the name of Lake Vermilion and Sudan Underground Mine State Parks, where that permit is not required, it's not required at the underground mine tour. And also, if you've been there, I think you will be there this summer, hopefully. As you go down the hill to Stunts Bay Boat Ramp, where the boathouses are, you do not need a sticker to enter that area as well. Section 23 would provide us the authority by written order to adopt temporary water surface controls at public construction and maintenance sites that cross or adjacent to waters of the state. The best example is the St. Croix River right now, St. Croix River Crossing Bridge. We've been working on establishing a no-wake zone there. As we're doing these bridge constructions, it's imperative to have a no-wake zone. Just one wake can cause that boom of that crane to go out of position, and safety is most paramount for this situation. There is some concern from some folks. I think the Association of General Contractors have a few concerns about the softness of this language, so we'll be working with them to come up with some alternative language between now and at the next hearing of this bill. Section 24 is a technical correction dealing with fire training, just changing the citation. Previously it said structural burn training procedures for Minnesota's technical college system, and now we're tying it to this National Fire Protection Association 104 requirement there. That carries on to section 25. Now we have a large portions of the bill, members, that was something that we wanted to try to address during the unsession discussions last year, but we had to go through some legal discussions as there's one auxiliary forest remaining within the state. So we're amending and repealing a lot of the auxiliary forest language in this bill. There's one left. These changes do not impact that forest, but this was a process that we had to establish these auxiliary forests and how they would work. So actually that goes through page 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 22 of the bill up to the top of 23. And I do have Director Forrest Bowe here if you'd like to talk about that. Actually, it does continue down to the next page. I apologize. So the next section that deals with, not deals with that section, would be section 45 on page 24, dealing with the Forrest Bowe account, not the Forrest Bowe. I knew I was going to say that, not Forrest Bowe account. So we're clarifying that the funds in the Forrest Bowe account can be used for special forest product information education programs, as well as educating people on the harvesting of these boughs. Section 46 deals with the change that was passed last year on a prohibition on once through cooling, and we're clarifying that we may issue permits for systems in existence prior to that law being into effect for up to 5 million gallons annually. These are closed loop systems that are buried in the ground. It's a very efficient way to heat or cool your home. Section 47, also there on 25.7-9, says that we may waive fees for past unpermitted appropriations for residential systems. These are related to those ones through cooling systems. We don't want to have to penalize somebody for coming into compliance and getting registered with us. Section 48 is just another technical correction, inserting the date for use under Minnesota Statutes 2014 for title examinations. Section 29 is something I've been working with, the department's been working with Representative Dill on, clarifying that the mine shaft at the Sudan Underground Mine State Park is not regulated by state elevator code, where you have to have buttons and brakes and doors that close and things like that. It's a mine shaft that is used and inspected under federal code. So the federal mine code for hoists that lift people under the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 30, Part 57, Subpart R, applies to our mine shaft at the mine, basically, is what it's saying. We have spoken with the Department of Labor and Industry, and our attorneys are all in agreement this language is acceptable. And we've had spoken with other committees. I believe they do not need to see that language. Section 50 relates to the changes in the ATV registration that are in the bill. We do not want to force a person to have to re-register their ATV. Rather, when you go to re-register your ATV after it expires, and if you now have one of these Class 2 or a side-by-side ATV that is 50 inches or less, it's some of the older Polaris Rangers and things that will now be a Class 1, you do that at the time of your expiration rather than spend the money to send out notices, make people come in and get a new sticker. I mean, we'll manage through this over the next period of the next 3 years. So it just makes sense to do that, and it provides us that authority to deal with that change there. Revisor's instructions, you can see that's related to the specific pieces there. And I apologize, you do not have these specific repealers in front of you. Maybe council could cover the repealers that are in the bill. Or I might be able to pull them up real quickly.
Mr. Chair, maybe while Ms. Taylor's looking to walk through the repealers, the one point of contention I think that's still being worked on in the bill, and Commissioner Meyer mentioned it, Section 23, and Ms. Burnett from the Builders is here, but I don't know if you need her to testify, Mr. Chair. She's working with the department, and they promised me they'll have it worked out when the bill gets before my committee. So I know she's right behind me, but I think she's probably just nodding yes, if I'm not mistaken.
I think we'll be fine, Representative McKay. Okay.
Thank you.
Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members, if members are interested, if you go to the initial original bill, House File 1329, instead of the DE amendment, you'll see the repealed language at the end. And it looks like the sections that are being repealed are regarding the auxiliary forest. It looks like all of them are.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, it would be the restrictions on new auxiliary forest tax rates, special taxes, and place in auxiliary forest by purchasers. That is in the bill.
Representative McNamara, we can we move to questions?
Yep, or we can just vote.
We got a couple of amendments yet, too. Questions, members? Representative Mezza?
I'll pass.
Okay. Why don't we take the amendments? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dill.
Okay, that's no problem.
Representative Dill.
Busy reading quick. I thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Line 10.27 in the bill regarding prohibited activities, regarding watercraft. Number 3 on line 10.27 would present a problem for a lot of lakes.
Mr. Chair, you
Are we on the bill,
I'm looking at the amendment? I'm looking at the bill. I couldn't find that same language in the amendment.
Okay.
Mine is upside down, right side up. And so
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I believe you go to 9.9.
Okay, well, I've got
you. Are you
talking about the construction area restrictions?
No. in the bill itself, because my amendment is upside down, right side up, different pages, mm-hmm. and so it's not in order. It was under prohibited activities. And the old language said prohibited night skiing or towing prohibited. So where would that be in the delete all?
Mr. Chairman, that language is actually going to be in the game and fish delete all because of the government relate.
We took that out of the bill.
State government, state and local government.
Okay, well, I had a problem with that because I mean, you're up at Voyager's Park. You're towing
later tonight, we can talk about that.
All the time. Sorry about that. Too many things at once.
All right. Members, I think we'll take the amendments now if it's okay with you. Oh, we have Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 24, section 46.
Of the delete all.
Of the delete all. Just want to clarify, as you were describing this, we're talking about once through uses of cooling water, but then you said something about a closed loop system, so that confused me. So,
Mr. Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Russo, yes, and I apologize for that. The prohibition is on once-through water permits. There was the bill that passed last year that exempted once-through cooling systems, or these pump-and-dump systems that are there. You can see the language that we're saying. The language I was referring to is actually on 24.29. It says that we may issue once-through system use permits on an annual basis for groundwater thermal exchange devices or aquifer storage and recovery systems. So these are not, in our minds, once-through cooling systems, but they're more of a closed-loop system.
Representative Urso?
Yeah, they're sort of closed, sort of not.
Well, they are.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to make sure I understood you properly. Do we have any concerns about the heat that it's picked up, you know, being dumped back into the aquifer? Are there any repercussions of that that people are going to worry about?
Mr. Meyer.
Chair, Representative Urso, I can forward you some other additional information. I'm not sure if I have anybody from our water.
Well, Representative Urso, this is just a closed-loop system. It stays in the system.
This water wouldn't be going back into the aquifer?
No. Representative Urso.
Well, on line 24.30, it says that return all once-through system water to the source aquifer.
Or aquifer storage and recovery systems that return. We could... Let me pull together staff, technical staff. I don't have that information right now. That's not the intent. We would have concerns about water being pulled out of the aquifer, yep, being circulated and deposited back again for health and safety purposes.
Okay, thanks.
Members, we have a couple of amendments I'd like to move at this time. There's one. I'll move the A3 amendment. This is a bill that I will be carrying, and we're going to be hearing it next week, but I'd like to put it in this bill. I think this comes from the four-wheel drive truck folks, and I believe they've been working with the DNR to put this together. They're going to be spending some money from their dedicated account to try to develop some trails, and I believe the user groups are okay with it. The DNR is okay with it. I think it's a good thing that we do this. So I would move the A3 amendment and take questions. Representative Metzler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say I hope we can find some matching funds in Legacy.
Okay. With that, I'll move the A3 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now on the A150195 amendment. Is Mr. Bone in the audience?
Yeah.
Ray, would you come down? This is some language I'm going to have a bill on as well. Traditionally, we put some of these ATV issues and off-road issues in the policy bill. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record and explain my amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Ray Bone. I'm here representing the All-Terrain Vehicle Association, Minnesota. I have the president of the All-Terrain Vehicle Association with me as well, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, George Radke, the president of the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota. Glad to be here.
Thank you for coming. Who's going to explain the amendment?
George.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay, I can. The first provision, Section 8, what we're running into is, as you know, we if we're on a trail, designated trail, and if we're with the family, and a lot of our folks ride as families, what happens is if they go off the trail and try to go into like a small town to have a hamburger and a Coke or something, if they have someone who's between 12 and 15 that doesn't have their driver's license, it's okay for them to ride on the trail, but once they get off the trail and they go into the municipality, we have COs that are ticketing them because the law doesn't allow it. So what this provision does is allow that, and again, as long as they're accompanied by an adult, that's the key, then they'll be able to do that. That's what we're trying to accomplish here. And George can talk about some of the experiences he's had.
With one of the biggest things is as you are riding with your family, as you come in and you need to get gas or it's time to eat dinner, basically, you've got a town sitting in front of you, but you can't get there. So you end up literally turning back around again or trying to find other ways to actually get into town. And or inadvertently, too many people are doing just exactly what Ray had mentioned. They're going anyway and breaking the law. Typically, though, they're with their families. They're supervised. And that's the big key part of this for us as well, too, is that we don't want to turn the streets open to kids by any means, but they need to be with a supervising adult.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what kind of speeds would we be talking about the vehicles being operated at?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uso.
What we're talking about is what would be dictated by the local authority.
Representative Russo, in a lot of these communities that are located next to some of these trails, they pass resolutions to allow ATVs in their town on the public roads, and they have to abide by those speed limits.
So,
Representative Russo.
I have some misgivings about this because we would not allow a 12-year-old to be behind the wheel of a car operating within the traffic rules of the city with the parents sitting right next to them.
Mr. Chairman.
If you're operating at similar speeds, and it's not as big a vehicle, granted, but if you're operating at similar speeds, this, we would not allow a 12-year-old on the city streets with a parent sitting within reach of the steering wheel. And this can't provide a greater level of supervision than that because you're not on the same vehicle. So I understand why you would want to do this. I get the motivation behind it. But the public roads are the public roads, and it's a different deal. And people have an expectation. The other people that use those roads have an expectation of safety, including pedestrians, little kids, you know, so little kids on bicycles and whatnot. And I don't know why we would do that when we wouldn't let someone between the ages of 12 and 16 do that, as I said, 15, excuse me, with the parents sitting right there. So I don't like this part. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Russo, I think, you know, these are people that, or kids that are certified. They're trained. They're certified on the actual vehicle itself. And we have an extremely good track record with those kids that are certified. And we... Right, and Representative McNamara makes a very good point. These machines are tailored to fit the kid, and typically they have a lot of riding experience because they are supervised. One of the key elements is the supervision. We believe that's critically important. We would never, ever approach you to do something like this unless they were supervised. Supervision, you know, goes a long, long ways, and I think if you talk to the conservation officers, they would tell you the same thing. You know, when we see kids that are unsupervised, that are out in these road ditches riding two or three on the vehicle, or even unsupervised riding around Grandpa's farm, that's you know, you're just inviting disaster. But when their parents are there, I don't think there's any safer way you could do it, frankly. And one of the benefits to this are the communities that are out there, because this is going to preclude them from coming in and having dinner with family, comes in, has dinner, you know, drops $50-$60 for dinner. This is precluding that if we don't do this.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get that. And certainly it's better with supervision than without supervision, but we would not allow the same thing with supervision if you put a box around this thing and call it a car. What? It wouldn't be allowed. And, you know, these kids have had safety training and all of that, and, you know, and a 15-year-old has all that safety training and everything before they turn 16 and we let them get a license.
Mr. Chair, I'm,
you know, if we could, you know, I understand that they've passed the ordinances to allow them, so they've declared them roadworthy and whatnot. But this is not a little motorized scooter. So it concerns me. And, you know, there has to be another way for the family to park the vehicle and get across the road to the hamburger stand or what, you know, wherever they're going, the restaurant and whatnot. So I'm okay with the size of the roads, you know, and the supervision is really, really critical to that, as you mentioned. But when it comes to a town road, it's kind of a different thing. So I guess if a town really would like to enable families to participate in their attractions, the town can find a way to provide some kind of corridor or something. But 12-year-olds on the city streets with a motorized vehicle, I'm not okay with.
Representative Mesa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They purchase gas for these vehicles to move, don't they? My mind, a gas tax should enable them to be on the roads anywhere. They're paying for it. It's a usage. And I actually have the opposite perspective. I hope that we can work to include two-wheeled all-terrain vehicles, dirt bikes, other things. I've been having some problems in one of my communities with ticketing in regard to that, and there are no other ways to get around. And, you know, I grew up with a bunch of fun kids, and we tooled around all over. Young kid, no difference to me, being on a lawnmower with a little summer business, riding lawnmower. I mean, where do we draw the line? In my mind, I think it's a good bill. I'd like to see it expanded a little bit to include some other modes of transportation that aren't just the ATVs.
Representative Cotterdam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifiers keep referring to the fact that these are family activities and in parental supervision, but that's not what the bill says. The bill is any 18-year-old, and I guess I would be accompanied by a person 18 years old or older with that holds a valid driver's license. I guess I'd be a lot more comfortable if it was parent or legal guardian.
Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we don't need corridors. We don't need any highfalutin system here. What we need is some relief for our conservation officers who are upholding the law. And we need to give both the conservation officers and people who ride ATVs on trails some clarity here. That's all we're attempting to do here. You got 4, 5, 6, 22 machines coming into a small town in northern Minnesota, and there's two cafes. This is a big deal for this community, and it's a big deal for the quality of the ride for the people. All we want to do is allow young people who are trained, who are supervised, to ride their machine the extra 3 blocks to get to the cafe to have a Coke and a hamburger. It's no big deal here. And please don't make more of this than what it is.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience like to speak for or against the amendment? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that the A15015 amendment be passed. I'm going to incorporate in my amendment that we delete everything after 2.32. Everything after line 2.32 would cause the bill to go to another committee, and we don't want that to happen. We've taken a number of issues out of this bill to try to avoid that issue. So I'm going to incorporate that into my amendment. Oh, except for line 3.12 and 3.13. Everything except those two lines. Understand the amendment? As amendment.
Representative Hackbart, you don't need that? Do you want that in?
We'd like to have that in the bill, Representative McNamara, but that would cause it to go to governor operations, and we don't want that to happen. That's another policy committee that we can't make the deadline.
Okay. Representative Hackbart, do we have the option of putting that in the Game and Fish bill? Because well,
that's correct.
We're already on top of that. All right.
That's
thank
correct.
You.
Okay.
I support deleting that line.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman,
If I may have the opportunity, I did not have a chance to review the A3 before it was adopted. This language does have some concern to the department, let alone the 2016 base funding changes, which I believe will be discussed in Representative McNamara's committee in the biennial budget. But talking about 60 days after the application has been locally approved and submitted, some of these trail corridors require environmental review. I think you may or may not have an amendment to deal with some of those things, but yep. These larger truck trails can be pretty complicated and take some time to do. So by saying that if the application is not approved within, denied or approved within 60 days, I think you're just forcing the commissioner to deny more applications rather than take the time it needs to actually work through these processes. So we need to discuss that. And the funding, though I understand the concerns, taking $150,000 out of the enforcement-based budget for OHV enforcement, I don't think is the right way to go. So I know that's not the purview of this committee, but I wanted to get on the record that we do have concerns about the amendment. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can discuss that and represent McNamara's committee, and when we hear the bill next week, we'll hear it separately as well. Okay. Any further discussion to the bill? On the bill as amended. Anyone in the audience have any other discussion to the bill as amended? Hearing none, Representative McNamara renews his motion that House File 1329 be re-referred to his committee on environment, policy, and finance as amended. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks. Bill is passed. To your committee, Representative McNamara, and thank you. Okay, next, Representative Dill.
We have amendment.
Ms. Lewis, would you like to come up? Representative Dill moves House File 1429. This is a bill that the Land Subcommittee put together, and Representative Dill is the author. Representative Dill moves House File 1429 and recommends that it be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Policy, and Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And because this bill has not left the committee and we were a division, or a subcommittee, I should say, there is the in your packet the DE2 amendment, which we adopted last night and brought into this amendment. So it's actually House File 1429 as amended with the DE2, which is in your packet. And included in the DE2 members are House File 138, which is Sundin, House File 214, which is Purcell, 295, which is Sundin, 447, which is Lewick, 547, which is Pawlowski, 816, which is Dill, 1082, which is Schoen, 1309, Gunther, 1650, Dill, and 322, Senate File 322, which is Goodhue County. And so if you took the names and bill numbers and looked at the 1429 as amended by the DE2, you would find all of those bills in the bill before us now. Now, Ms. Lewis is with us, and it's been normal procedure over the years, whether I've been in the majority or the party opposite has been in the majority, that we always had a land bill, at least until it got to the House floor, that was agreed upon by the members and by the appropriate state agencies, such as in this case, all of these are affected by DNR. But we have had bills in the past that where it was a MnDOT issue, and someone from MnDOT came up and talked about whether they approved or whether they didn't approve. And we've always only taken the non-controversial or where there was peace in the valley on the bills, and that's what we have before us. And I'd ask, Ms. Chairman, if you give me the latitude to ask Ms. Lewis publicly at this time if in fact, she has reviewed all the bills that I wrote off and that are included, and included in the DE amendment to the 1429 if they're all acceptable to the department.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals, DNR. The DNR has reviewed the bills that were included in the DE2 amendment and has no concerns about the bills.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Chairman.
Representative Dill, the DE2 amendment is part of the House File 1429 at this time.
That is correct. Thank you. So then, Mr. Chairman, as always happens, we always have bills that come in after the deadline, whether it's on May, the last day of adjournment, or the date that was set here to get all your bills in. It's just the normal thing, and you will see this as we go along in the process about people coming in, and you'll see it in the next committee that's going to in Ways and Means, and then on the House floor, and then all of those things. On the House floor, there might be a controversial amendment that we discuss that isn't agreed to by an agency and by the members. But we do have two so-called latecomers today that I would like to propose to add into the 1429 as amended. And the first one is one from up in my district, which is Lake County, and it is to amend the delete everything amendment, and it is coded A150197. And is that in everyone's possession in the committee?
It is.
Okay, this is a Lake County amendment, and I would ask Mr. Chairman if I might have the latitude if Ms. Lewis has any comments on this amendment.
Representative Dill, I think the 0197 is the Dakota County one.
Yep, that's Dakota. I've got to do Lake. Okay, I'm sorry. It is the A150184.
Correct.
Yep, I'm sorry.
And Ms. Lewis, you give it the blessing?
Mr. Chair, the DNR has been working with the county on the parcels included in this amendment. It's part of a data center proposal, and we have worked out an agreement with the county, and the bill reflects the agreement worked with the county. The DNR supports the amendment.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Dill.
Thank you. And now to the A150197, which is the Dakota County
Representative Dill, do you want to move that amendment, or does Representative McNamara want to move it? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, and Representative Dill, you laid it out very well. It came to me in the last hour. Ms. Lewis has been gracious enough to look at it and look at it with the chair. I think it is to the point of being non-controversial, but I have promised Ms. Lewis, if it's not right, that I'll take it out in either one of the next two stops if she tells me it doesn't have her blessing. But I believe, Mr. Chair, I mean, Dakota County's here if you want, but it's really non-controversial. It was a middle of a road that got titled incorrectly, and I think it should be non-controversial.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We did not see this amendment before we came to the hearing today. The information provided by the county makes sense. It does not appear to be a controversial issue. It doesn't appear to border water. If all that checks out, we'll go back and check that out. If all that checks out, we are fine with the bill.
Very good. If there are any issues do develop with this particular issue, please bring it to our attention so we can take it out of the bill. That's kind of the agreement that we've got. So thank you for that. All in favor of the 0197 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Anything further, Representative Dill?
No, Mr. Chairman, unless another member of the committee has another amendment that they would like to offer to the bill, I'm ready to move the 1490
amendments. Anyone else have any questions, comments? Anyone in the audience like to speak for or against the lands bill? Seeing none, Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 1429, as amended, be re-referred to the committee, the Environment Committee on Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed. Members, I think that concludes our business for now. We will be coming back at 6:15 this evening to do the Game and Fish Bill. We will be the 300 South. The committee hearing will be in 300 South at 6:15. Any other comments? We are in recess.
The Planning and Outdoor Recreation Committee. Representative McNamara has House File 1070. Representative McNamara moves House File 1070. And Representative McNamara will be holding this over for possible inclusion. Representative McNamara also has the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he'd like. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and the bill is in the shape you like. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is to move the discussion of trapping and dogs forward. I think it's got some real positive aspects about it.
what it says, and there is still a little bit of a challenge, Mr. Chair. Basically, folks, if you're aware, a lot of the issue centers around what's commonly called the 220 body gripping traps, which fit in, it's like a shoebox container they're currently used, what's called a cubby. And you set the trap in the cubby and you put the bait behind it, and currently it has an overhang on that cubby, with the thought being that it, a dog then doesn't reach in and get the trap, but yet the targeted fur bears you're trying to get fit in and then get caught in the trap. And what we're saying in this bill, that we would move those, they're called cubby, so I'll use that term, members and Mr. Chair. We would not allow those cubbies on the road right away. And many times folks that aren't familiar with trapping don't realize, but a significant amount of trapping happens on road right aways. And this would be a huge step for the trappers to say, you know what, we won't have any cubbies on road right away. Mr. Chair, the challenge is, and I met with the trappers today and they made a good point, as this issue moves forward, what we said was that public roads mean any state, county, city, or township road. Where we get into a gray area potentially, and those of you in northern Minnesota would understand this, or in some of the far and northwestern, like Representative Fabian, Representative Dill's district, Anzell, you can get into what are often referred to as minimum maintenance roads, but some minimum maintenance roads really don't think and look and act like what we think of roads, but they are on road right-of-way, either with easement or actual ownership. They could almost look like a hayfield. Some of them actually are mowed and hayed and such, and so that's one challenge we have, Mr. Chair, in identifying. I don't want people to get tickets for when they had no idea they were actually on the road, but it is. So that's one of the areas. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I didn't even look behind me. There could be people for or against the bill. I just, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you giving a hearing. I know it's very controversial. The Senate's taken a different approach. I'm not interested in going is where some of those are going. So that's what my bill's about.
Very good. Questions, members? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. You talked about a fair number of roads there that this would affect. How about Forest Service roads? Those are open to the public and they're open to traffic.
They are not included in this. No ATV trails, no Forest Service, no logging roads are included. Right, Gary, we did that. They're specifically, I would want to note that they're specifically excluded if we needed to, but I was only wanting to identify what was included,
okay.
And it's not my intention to include any of those such things. And Mr. Chair, I didn't say it would include state trails, so this would include, and it only applies to the public right-of-way or the public easement area. It does not apply to private property. So if the road right-of-way was only a total of 33 feet wide and you have permission to trap on the private land, you can trap on the private land.
Representative Dill.
Well, that would go to the Stoneville, like for example, the state corridor trail for Stoneville, and those are generally do not have easements, they have permits on them. So because even though it was a state trail, that would mean that it would still be open.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Dill, I think the definition of public trail in 85015 really isolates it to state trails when I think of them like Paul Bunyan Trail or Mesabi Trail, places like that is really, it's pretty targeted. I do not believe it would extend to, I mean, we have many, many miles of snowmobile trails.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment here. At least in my area, the vast majority of the township roads that we deal with have got a 33-foot off-center line right-of-way, or in some cases a fee title easement. a lot of those areas are not going to be fenced, so there's I always see some continuing issues with this, because you're going to be 17 feet on most private property where I live right up off the bat if we go 50 feet. I'm afraid we're going to end up with a we'll be on the right-of-way, off the right-of-way, in these areas where we don't have fences. The townships may or may not keep that right-of-way clean right to the last foot. There may be trees right along, and those low-maintenance roads, typically they're going to be 66 feet wide, at least where I come from, and we've got about 80 townships up there. That's the standard. So to say I'm uncomfortable with this is probably an understatement. But just that 33 feet's the standard where I'm at. So 50 feet, and this is mostly in the rural stuff. When you get into a state highway, that's a whole different situation. But I'm not comfortable yet with where we're at.
Mr. Chair, if I could just address that. The standard roadway right-of-way oftentimes is 66 feet. Yeah. As Representative Lewick said, 33 feet from the center line. This bill does not apply beyond that 33 feet. It's only the road right-of-way. So if you're trapping on private property, you're free to do that. This bill would not apply, assuming you had permission or it was property that could be trapped legally without permission.
Other questions from members? Okay, we have some folks that would like to testify. Scott Slocum. Members, we're going to do this bill, and then we're going to do the game of fish bill. And we're going to be done by 8 o'clock, our regular hour and 45 minutes. So we're limiting testimony to, what were we told, 2 minutes each? I think folks that called in that wanted to testify have been told that. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just state your name and you represent for the record.
Yeah, my name is Scott Slocum. I'm from White Bear Lake. And I appreciate the definition of public trail, public road, and public trail. That adds to the bill. I'm disappointed in the amendment that limited it to one size of trap. The definition of public road is a good one here. And, the right-of-way is something that... The right-of-way is something that was discussed the other night in the Senate subcommittee, too, and as a problem. And this solves that problem. A lot of people would have had that problem if this right-of-way feature hadn't been put in. However, this amendment today did change a couple... It did change the size of the traps. It would regulate only the 220 size traps now. My dog was killed 3 years ago in a 160 size trap. Now, the danger in this is that people walk with their roads, with their dogs along roads, and they walk with their dogs along trails. And so the intention here is good. It's to protect those dogs. It's a very common situation with people walking along with their dogs, and a lot of dogs are killed that way, and so this is a good step in the right direction. I wish it would still cover the smaller body dipping traps like the one that killed my dog, Jack Russell Terrier. The dachshunds are of that size too, and they're determined. They'll go for that bait. They'll be attracted to the bait, and they'll stick their heads direct into that box, into that trap, very quick, while their owners are walking with them. And one of those cases was near a trail that would not be covered by this. I'm thinking of a case a couple of years ago that was in the paper, a girl with her little dachshund. The dachshund was... They were at a hunting area, I think, and near the parking area. So it would be good to cover the buffer. It would be good if this buffer was to cover the parking areas as well. That would cover that case. The girl was playing with her dog near the trail, and the dachshund was killed in a small trap that was set near the trail. So it's a good step in the right direction. For that, I say thank you.
Questions for Mr. Slocum? Thank you for your testimony. Next, Gary. Nice to go. State your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Lestcom, an attorney with the Minnesota Trappers Association, who I'm representing here tonight. We have, for a long time, worked with all groups in the process of trying to eliminate conflicts with other user groups from trapping. This is one of them. As to 1070, I think our primary concern at this point does come down to, as Representative Luick indicated, the definition of public road. For the most part, it wouldn't change, this bill wouldn't change existing law, except in those situations where there's private land within 50 feet of a public road or a public trail. Minnesota, as far as the public trail, Minnesota statute section 85.015 does include most of the primary trails. But on public roads, there's a vast difference between public roads throughout the state. I think that this language could possibly include some forest roads if it would be constructed by a county or a township. Especially, there's a lot of county land that the county will go in and push open the forest road. It would be a county road in that case. And it would be applicable. The Senate bill incorporated Minnesota Statute 160.02, subdivision, I believe, 26, which has to do with the description of public roads, which would be much broader, including cartways and that type of thing. My concern isn't just so great as to which road it applies to or not. In the practical sense that you can go out and see on the landscape so that there's been construction. There are many, many, many roads that are dedicated throughout the state on public land and private land, cartways on section lines, quarter section lines, other dedicated lands in subdivision, those type of things, where the road has never actually been constructed. You can't see it, and there's thousands of them. And the only way you could know is to basically hire an attorney, go to the county recorder's office, and look at where that land has been dedicated. It still would meet the definition. It is a public road. It is owned by the public through title or easement, and the trapper would have no opportunity to know that there's an actual road, and they'd be in violation of this with criminal penalties. Trappers are trying to set where they're not going to catch dogs, but they wouldn't be able to see this on the landscape would be our concern. I don't think trappers typically set within 50 feet of the middle of what any of us would consider a primary road with this type of trap. And so that would be our concern with the language as it is currently. Okay. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Lestcom? Thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Christopher. Welcome to the committee. State your name and who you represent for the record.
Nancy Christopher. I represent myself.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman Hackworth. I sent all of you an analysis that I did of the body gripping trap problem back in January. And in that, one of the things that I found is that the issues where we're killing dogs really comes down to your unethical, your uneducated, you're lazy, don't care. It's kind of a minority of trappers. The MTA actually does a very good job of educating trappers, of communicating to trappers to stay away from risky sets, things like that. So we're really dealing with a group that doesn't necessarily care what the ethical rules are, what the right thing to do is. They care about getting whatever they're trying to catch. So my concern with the amendments to this are specifically that it excludes 160s. If you start excluding 220s from ditches, what are these guys going to do? They're going to put a 160 in the ditch. 6-year-old Ella was walking behind her dog Shotzi when her dog was killed in a body gripping trap, a 160. 4.5-month-old Bear, large black labs start out as small puppies, was killed in a body gripping trap, a 160. Mr. Slocum's dog was killed in a 160. So the concern is that the less ethical, unfortunately they're there, are going to resort to that in the ditches, and the ditches are actually going to become more dangerous. We're going to actually see more dogs. My second concern has to do with the way it's excluding trails. This was a huge concern with grouse hunters at Game Fair. We picked up over 800 petitions being signed by hunters at Game Fair wanting dog safe trapping methods. Their concern were trail sets while they're grouse hunting. And we have some dogs killed in that manner. My third issue is with the half-submerged water sets. Where you have the roads meeting culverts and small streams going through, especially during hunting season, that's where the dogs go to get a drink. A half-submerged trail set, water set, can be set in as little as 4 inches of water. My own property, my family hunts my property. Before the ice, before the creek freezes, they have to go up on the road to skirt the creek. The dogs are in the water. There should be a body gripping trap in there. If we make it so that even 2 feet of water or less would have to be fully submerged, that could help correct that problem. We have over 5,400 petitions asking for dog safe trapping methods. 4,800 of those are from Minnesota. We recognize that this is not a trapper issue. The majority of trappers do a great job. We've talked to them. We're dealing with this other group that's making it not a trapping issue, but an issue of our laws allowing unsafe trapping methods. And that affects anyone who owns a dog, uses the outdoors. They all have a stake in this issue. So I would ask you to, I love the idea of protecting the ditches because it's such a threat to our people, but we really need to try to do a little more there. In the study, I concluded with, you know, you can fix where we put these traps, or you can fix how we put these traps. My preference is let good trappers do their thing. Let them put them next to the road. Let them put them next to the trails. Get them in boxes. Make them safe. Then it's a non-issue. And the extra work might just kick the bad apples out of the game, which, you know what, would be great for the sport of trapping. They stink up the place. They give the sport a bad name.
Thank you for your testimony. There might be some questions for members' questions.
Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
Denise Schultz.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Denise Schultz. I'm from Victoria, Minnesota, and I am representing Canine Search Midwest. We're an all-volunteer group. I've got some of the other members with me. They may be speaking later. I'm going to read this because I don't want to forget any of my points, and I know I only have 2 minutes, and I'm going to talk fast. I'm a canine handler for an all-volunteer search and rescue group here in Minnesota. Because there are so few live-find dogs, our call-out area is regional. I've been on searches on the Gunflint Trail in Roseau, Chisholm, Crosby, Brainerd, Garrison, and Thief River Falls, as well as a number of other Minnesota and Wisconsin locations. I'm here because these body gripping traps pose a real danger for our search and rescue dogs. I've searched with my canine partner for an armed and paranoid subject, centering into old buildings with rotted floors, up and down steep riverbanks in the dark, and generally put her in jeopardy in many ways. It's risky and it's sometimes scary, but nothing scares me like these traps. Traps on the ground, even in current legal cubbies, are killing dogs. And I've heard it said there are a lot of dogs in Minnesota, so who cares if a few of them get killed? The dog should be on a leash anyway, right? Area search dogs work off-leash and are trained to find either specific human scent or all humans in the search area. Why work off-leash? Dogs work many times faster when not tethered to a human. Leashes along lines get tangled and brush can pose a real hazard to both the dog handler and the dog. Off-leash, the search dog can access areas that humans can't. Brushy riverbanks, small caves, collapsed buildings, and so on. Air scent dogs range quite a distance from the handler and are often out of sight. These traps are set and placed by humans. Even if scent blocking measures are taken, there is a human scent trail to the trap that a search dog will follow. Some people say these traps can be removed in time to save the dog's life. We've practiced trying to open these traps with zip ties and other methods that just didn't work. Besides, these traps kill instantly, so trap removal is a secondary concern, and you're still taking a dead dog home at the end of the day. I want to tell you what's lost if these dogs are killed in a trap. I believe there are less than 10 fully certified air scent dogs in Minnesota at this time, and I'm talking about dogs that are trained to find live humans where time is of the essence. we fund all our own costs, so there's also a huge monetary commitment on the part of the handlers and our support personnel. My final point is this. If a search and rescue dog is killed in a trap, there is a cost in human terms as well. A dead dog is not going to go find that missing hunter with a broken leg, the Alzheimer's walk away, or the missing two-year-old. Do you have any questions?
Questions, member? Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you for coming. Second time today, I've brought up the fact that my brother Charlie does search and rescue, and my kids all participated in the training of his dog and other dogs. We have no idea how often dogs are going out on searches. This is one of the points my brother made to me in an email earlier today, that we don't hear about the people that got found. And the areas that they might be sending a dog into are anywhere, frankly, anywhere. So, it's a good step to take care of the roadsides. I'm hearing this issue that it's not, only the one-size trap, although the search and rescue dogs are the bigger dogs. So I hope we can continue to work on that.
Thank you for your comments. I would add, there was a woman found by a live fine dog up in Chisholm, and I don't know how far off the road she was, but that dog went through a wet ditch, a couple culverts and so on. If there had been traps in there, I don't think she'd have been found, because the dog would have either got caught or killed. So it's something that is a real danger, even if it's right by the side of the road.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Kurt Warner? I don't know if I got your name right. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
I'm Kurt Berner.
Berner. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I had a Southern German grandfather who wouldn't convert. So. Anyway, Kurt Berner, I'm here representing Dog Lovers for Safe Trapping Minnesota. Thank you very much for your time and for the opportunity to put my comments into the public record. My story started in the fall of 2011. I took a day off to work for grouse hunting late season. I was hunting up near the McGrath area, and by coincidence, I stopped at the DNR station to check about were there body grip traps in the area. They said, well, there may be a few, but they'll mostly be in the ditches. I was somewhat reassured by that. So I continued on to the grouse hunting spot, which was on public lands. Set my dog out, sent her off, and she's a pointing dog, and her range in the woods would be 125 to 150 yards. Can't see her in grouse woods. I was about 200 yards from my vehicle when I came across the cubby. Beautifully set cubby, totally ethical, totally legal. I knew what it was. I got the dog back immediately, grabbed her collar, and went back to the car, and that began my saga as of 3 years ago. I wrote a letter to Commissioner Landwehr at the time, got a prompt response back from Mr. Vargas, and he said that the DNR was happy to look at this and wanted to make the world safe for trappers and productive for trappers as well as for hunters and a shared resource, which is the right way to look at things. But please note, that was in 2012. We're still here. We're coming back. These traps are killing dogs. These traps are maiming dogs, and the legally set traps on public and private lands are killing dogs, and we would like to see that changed. Our numbers, and these numbers are really kind of floaty. We've talked to the DNR numerous times, but according to our analysis of DNR-provided numbers, 71% of the dogs killed in this trapping season were killed by legally set traps. Coming back to me, in 2014, I didn't buy a hunting license in Minnesota. I'm not going to subject my dogs to that. My circle of friends who are upland bird hunters also with dogs, and I've decided to go elsewhere. So it's six people that we've taken out of the economy from Minnesota, from northern Minnesota particularly, where we're not staying in hotels, restaurants, bars, etc. during the fall hunting season. In a loose analysis, this translates into thousands of dollars. Politics is a numbers game. You know that way better than I do. But there are roughly 10,000 licensed trappers in the state. There are approximately 150,000 waterfowl and other hunters combined, most of whom would hunt with dogs in the field. About 53% of the households in the state have dogs.
all of these dogs are in jeopardy to body grip traps. I'd ask you to, as you vote on this, as the process continues, please remember that disparity moving forward. And I believe, and Dog Lovers for Safe Trapping believes that trappers have a niche in this outdoor arena. The management of raccoons and skunks and those kinds, we take our hats off to the trappers for doing that. It produces more waterfowl, it produces more upland birds when there are less skunks and coons, etc. So we're not after the trappers. We think the law needs to be fixed, and we'd like to see you do that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the testimony. Questions, members? Thank you for your time.
Sure.
Dick Kimmel. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. My name is Dick Kimmel. I live in New Orleans, Minnesota. I'm a hunter. I own a dog, and I worked for the DNR for 29 plus years. I thought I'd never sit in one of these seats again after I retired, but I'm here because I care about this issue. I volunteered for the Dog Lovers for Safe Trapping Minnesota to conduct a survey to gather opinions from the public about this issue. Basically, it was an opinion survey regarding the trapping laws in Minnesota, the result in dogs killed in traps. The complete survey is online. Each of you should have an executive summary from the survey, and I encourage you to take a look at the report. It's many pages, but we've copied and pasted an open-ended question, the comments derived from that. I'm going to basically just go over the five questions. It was a short survey. We had 133 respondents that represented a number of groups. We were primarily after hunters that hunted with dogs, but we had some trappers that responded to the survey, as well as search and rescue dog owners and pet owners. And I don't know how a lot of them got the survey, but it circulated pretty fast. 95% of the survey respondents had concern that traps can kill a dog, and they're set at a time when they're hunting. 88% were very concerned that the traps were in the field when they were hunting. 65% of the respondents indicated that the traps that can kill a dog that are set when they're hunting changes the way they hunt, or whether they hunt in Minnesota. Many say they stop hunting when trapping season comes in. Many of these indicated that they go to other states and they no longer buy a Minnesota license. Nearly all of the respondents were from Minnesota. Again, I took comments from the email recipients and put them right in the survey, and it paints a pretty graphic picture of people's attitudes about this. The most common comment, of course, was that there's a need for Minnesota to modify the trapping laws. There were unkind comments at the state government of Minnesota to allow this to go on for so long. Again, those are in there if you want to take a look at them. Some of the respondents articulated their heartbreak at losing a dog or a pet, and some of the respondents suggested specific modifications, things like conibear traps, a minimum of 5 feet over the ground or completely submerged in water. That's the essence of the report, but I really encourage you to go look at the report and read some of the comments from Minnesota residents, sportsmen, search and rescue people, and some trappers, too.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions, members? Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Constantine.
You're the bluegrass musician?
Yep.
No.
Yeah, that's what I retired to do. They asked me not to bring my banjo and sing about the problem. So. Thank you for your testimony. Shay Adlin?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did I get your name right?
Yes, yeah.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sherry Adlin. I'm from Coon Rapids, Minnesota. I'm here today with my seventh grade granddaughter. Our family owns and hunts hunting retrievers. We train, master, and finished an upland hunting retrievers. We have a lot of friends who, along with us, no longer hunt here during trapping season because of the fear of what will happen to our not only highly trained but our much beloved pets, who are members of our family. I would just like to say that I'm also concerned about the fact that this bill only talks about 220s and doesn't go down as far as a 160. I think it should include all of them. And while I'm really encouraged that this group is looking at making our roadways and ditches safer, I would also like to see some changes to make trapping safer all around, because the dogs that are being killed in legally set traps aren't really going to be affected by this anyway. The traps need to be up off the ground or set in a safe manner, and I would urge you all to look at the Senate bill that's being looked at this time. I have been asked to read a letter by a woman whose family lost a dog to a trap. If you would kindly indulge me the opportunity to read this to you quickly. I'll skip some and I'll be quick.
You've got less than a minute left.
Okay. This family was outside with their dogs. They had a dog that had new puppies, and in about a 5-minute span of time, the dog went missing. So they started looking for her, and they called 911 and notified all the social media. They took a break from their search to look to feed puppies every 2 or 3 hours, and obviously this was an emotional time for them, very traumatic for the children. So they went and used thermal imaging to look for the dog. They walked in the ditches and drove the roads, and they couldn't find her, and at this point it's 40 below. 6:30 in the morning in the extreme cold, the neighbors are out helping to look for the puppies yet again. Lily had gone viral by this point on all the social media. At 11 a.m. they took a break, fed puppies again, and they took a final check, decided to go down by the creek thinking maybe she had fallen in. They went to the bottom of the hill where the creek is. One went left, one went right. The woman took their other dog, Isabella, with. She says, "We walked for half an hour. Where the creek comes to the road, Isabella came to a stop and let out this horrible cry, a howl. I take off running up over the road, and on the other side of the road I find Lily, dead, her body wrapped in a barbed wire from the fence with a metal thing around her neck. She was dead, frozen stiff in a patch of tall, dry grass. I was heartbroken, screaming and crying, running to get my husband. I called him right away and called 911. They knew who I was. I reported I had found her, and she's been killed in some sort of trap. While we waited for the police, I started taking photos. When the DNR officer arrived, they got Lily out of the ditch, but they couldn't get the trap off of her. It was broken. She was frozen, and it was cold. The DNR officer took her to get the trap off of her. We had to tell our children and all of our friends that with deepest regrets, Lily's been found, and she's no longer with us. My children cried and became angry. How could someone set a trap so close to our house? It could have been one of the kids caught in that trap, riding bike or snowmobile, walking in the ditch. This is our neighborhood, where my kids and the neighbor kids play, where they chase each other back and forth, pick agates, build forts. Our safety's been taken from us, and being scared is the new norm. The next 2 days were really emotional while we waited to get Lily back from the DNR. The kids couldn't sleep, they were having nightmares, the puppies needed to be fed, the dog was having issues as well. She wouldn't eat, she wouldn't sleep, she would have nightmares when she did, and she would cry. We got Lily back, but we were very angry anyway. We lost a family member due to a trapper. If he would have set that trap with more consideration, we would still have our Lily. We thawed the ground and dug her grave, and the kids built a cross out of wood. My husband and I went and wrapped Lily in a sheet, and shut her jaw and her eyes as best we could so our kids could have some closure. We carried her to the grave, and the kids said their goodbyes, crying, "It's not fair." Isabella was crying too, trying to dig her back out, and then she would run around licking the children's faces. When the burial was through, we went back in the house to feed the puppies, and they all went crazy. We figured out when we picked them up, they could smell their mama on us. So the next 2 weeks were exhausting, trying to raise and feed these puppies, handle our emotional trauma, get enough sleep, go to work and school. We had a lot of support from neighbors. Our other dog, Isabella, continued to be depressed. She would go and lay by Lily's grave and cry and try to dig her out. She wouldn't come in for hours. My family couldn't take much more. All of this caused by a guy who lived an hour away, didn't know us, and decided to set a trap line from Cushing, Minnesota, all the way to Pequot Lakes. He would drive his truck to an open waterway, open his door, step down, set up a box with a 220 Conibear trap inside, with a safety latch that didn't work, and a recess in the box that was not right, and drive off. The worst part is that my family endured all of this for his laziness. The rule that allows traps to be set like this only 500 feet from residential areas is not enough. It is crazy. The rules are not safe, and they need to be changed. Respectfully, Rosie and Darren Nordby. Thank you.
Questions, members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anything further, Representative McNamara? Anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill?
Chairman, I appreciate giving the hearing. I know it's a difficult subject for a lot of folks. I didn't know if DNR wanted to speak at all or not.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Well, we don't have a formal position on this bill. We do have a position on the issue, and we've spoken to the Senate in the past couple of days about the issue and working on it with some of these stakeholders. We do need to come up with some solutions that will reduce these dogs being caught in these traps. So we do appreciate you listening to Representative McNamara's bill and working on this important issue. Thank you.
Can I give testimony?
Sure. You got 2 minutes.
Chairman.
Oh, Representative Manziel, you had a question for Commissioner Meyer?
Just real quickly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meyer, as a committee member here and a member of the legislature, pretty compelling to listen to what we just listened to. And it's pretty compelling to have listened to this at least 2 or 3 years previous. And this is an issue that just won't go away. And I'm wondering if you feel there is potential for some common ground. Representative McNamara is working his tail off to find that common ground, but oftentimes common ground is very elusive unless the department helps us out a little bit. So would you comment on that, please?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Manziel, we do want to try to find common ground. Obviously, you know, our mission is to have recreational opportunities and also maintain healthy populations of animals. So, and to also recruit and keep people hunting in the state of Minnesota. So anything we can do to help further this conversation along, we're more than willing to do. It often takes a lot of give and take among all sides to come up with those issues. We had a proposal back in 2012 that we put on the table that began the discussion. Unfortunately, it never went anywhere. Talked about restrictions, heights 4 feet up, completely submerged, and a setback box, cubby set. You know, people have concerns about that. I think we can put that back on the table. We can talk about that, but you know, we need to figure out how to keep people hunting in Minnesota and people being safe with their dogs.
And keep people trapping.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. We need to make sure that the trappers, and that's what I was talking about, maintaining healthy populations. I think you heard testimony about the predators that are taken this way. You know, the fox, the raccoons, the skunks, those types of animals do a lot of damage to our birds, not only our game birds, but our songbirds and other wildlife as well. So we do need to maintain that as well. So anything we can do, participate in discussions, provide our technical knowledge and resources, we're more than willing to do.
I appreciate the commitment and the answer.
Okay, sir, did you want to come up? Welcome to the committee. State your name and who you represent for the record.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here. My name is Frank Trapanese. I'm from Redwood, Minnesota. I'm here as a citizen and a dog owner. I'd like to say that I've been a hunter and an outdoors person since the mid-1950s when I was old enough to enter the woods with a 22 on my own. I'm not anti-trapping. I have not lost a dog to a trap, and I don't want to, but I do have some concerns. I don't want to run out of time here, but I have a concern about the 150-foot rule. I paced it off this morning, took my dog out and threw the ball. She covered that distance in 5.8 seconds. That doesn't give us a lot of margin. I'm also not here to blame or scapegoat trappers. I think trapping is a rich tradition in Minnesota. It's also necessary for pest and predator control. I am here to make a couple of points and ask this committee to consider substantive change. We've heard how many dogs and waterfowl hunters and trappers and things like that. We've also heard that there's probably 10 or fewer air scent search dogs. There's about 1 million dogs in the state of Minnesota. Contrary to some of the things that have been said in the past on this issue, the majority of dog trapping deaths have been in perfectly legal sets. The dog Kobe that was killed in December near Cloquet, I'm sorry, was not killed in December, was caught in a trap. This dog had his head swollen 2 to 3 times the normal size. The eyes had been removed. He lost hearing in one ear. This all occurred in a perfectly legal set.
Hold it now. Keep order. Keep. Continue. Continue. Please continue.
To the trapper's credit of Kobe, he did everything right. He followed the rules in setting his trap. He called the conservation officer. He self-reported. As I understand it, they freed the dog. In spite of grave injuries, the dog was brought for medical attention. You might ask why they didn't just put the dog out of its misery as badly injured as it was, but as I understand that story, as the humans approached, the dog's tail began to wag. This trapper is not a bad person, and he was not cited, nor should he have been. He acted legally at the best of his ability to do the right thing. I think the problem we have in Minnesota is not bad trappers. I don't think it's an education problem. I think trappers, like the rest of us, are by and large going to follow the regulations that are set out for them. I am here to respectfully lay this problem at the feet of the people on this committee and say that the committee needs to not simply nip around the edges of this problem, but they need to take responsibility and show leadership, and they need to fix this problem. If you've ever seen a body grip trap go off, it's violent, and it's a dangerous instrument, but it can be used safely and effectively. Putting them up 5 feet or putting them fully underwater would make them safe. What I'm asking here is that we need regulations in Minnesota that allow the 8,000 to 10,000 trappers we have to trap and at the same time protect our million dogs, hunting hounds, search and rescue dogs, canine officers, service dogs, dogs that serve blind people, that serve returning veterans as companions, dogs that serve people with seizures, and just plain old household pets. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Questions, members? Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to say, as everyone now knows, I owe Chairman Hackbart a big thank you for letting us have a hearing. This is an extremely difficult hearing to have, and it's not easy for people to sit and listen to this. And I know many of the people, including Chairman and Representative Dill, the minority lead, myself, are all bird hunters ourselves and are big hunters and have dogs. And at the same time, we know the importance of having been a former trapper as a child myself and the tradition and all that. This is a real tough issue, and where on one side people will argue, well, there isn't really that many dogs lost. Well, one too many dog when it's your dog or somebody you know or anybody you talk to is too many in a lot of respects, and I get that. And when we put this original legislation that we put in, I believe it was 4 years ago now, I think it's made a big improvement, and I think as we go forward, I'll continue to work on it. The dialogue has gotten much better. There was a time a couple years ago when it was very ugly, and I appreciate the calm here for a while has allowed us to understand. This, Representative Van Zalk, I appreciate your mentioning that we need to try and find a spot in between. I'm not convinced, Representative Van Zalk, on this, that there is a spot in between, because if you listen to the testimony on both sides, my bill didn't go as far as they want it to go, and so it's an extremely tough one. And we all like the trappers taking out the skunks and all the bad things that are getting our birds, and they don't only get game birds. They get a lot of little Tweety birds that people don't like, too. So this is a tough one. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move the bill to be laid over, I think, at this point in time, unless there's...
We'll have one more testifier, Representative McNamara, okay. One more member of the audience that would like to speak.
Sir.
And we've given great latitude to the people that have come forward. Everyone has taken more than 2 minutes.
and it will take less than 2 minutes.
Very good, thank you. And we have another bill to do that will probably take over an hour, and we're going to do it in less than an hour. So we will be done here at 8 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Benson. I'm with Canine Search Midwest. I'm the operations officer.
Welcome.
I'm the guy who sets up the problems. I don't own a dog, but I'm part of the pack. And I will not reiterate what my colleague Denise talked about, but one of the things that occurred to me when I saw a body grip trap activated 18 months ago, I immediately wrote a letter to my representative Jim Dabney, and the way I see the body grip traps, and I believe the laws need to be changed so that they're fully submerged and or 5 feet off the ground. I see a similarity with years ago people built pools in the ground and they put trampolines in their backyard. Laws were changed. They called these attractive nuisances. People had to put fences around their yards to keep kids away, kids diving. And I see body grip traps, particularly body grip traps, as a similar attractive nuisance. Thank you.
Questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Representative McNamara renews his motion that House File 1070, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Okay, next up is House File 1406. The chair will move House File 1406, and we will be moving that to the Government Operations Committee. So I will move House File 1406. Next, I will move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like. All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Meyer.
Just what you wanted.
We trying to avoid some committees. We're up against deadlines. We do have to go to gov ops anyway, so we've got a couple of other amendments that I'd like to put on the bill now, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I think you're aware of those amendments.
Mr. Chair, just one question for you. Sorry, Your Honor.
Sure.
I have a fact sheet that was started with the bill that's kind of struck out. Would that help if I distributed that?
Absolutely, that's fine.
Just walk
one of the pages
it?
Would pass on. We'll pass those out. The amendments that are left are a couple of issues that were in the policy bill earlier that we did this afternoon. And that bill, we took them out of that bill because we didn't want this bill to have to go to GovOps, but this one has to go there anyway. So I will move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment is the issue with the motorized trails that we took out of the other bill. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. And members, the A2 amendment is the construction area restrictions. That has to do with yeah, it's an exemption for rules making requirements. So anything to do with rules has to go to GovOps. So I would move the A2 amendment. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. That amendment's adopted. Now the bill's in the shape that we'd like, Commissioner, and if you want to proceed with explaining what we've got left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And those two amendments, I believe, we covered this afternoon, so I'm not going to touch on those. And what I have handed out is a strikeout copy of our fact sheet, what's remaining in our Game and Fish Bill. A lot of things have come out just because of deadlines and things like that that we're having to reach. So if you go to the fact sheet, Section 4 actually is Section 1 now, and what we're talking about, this language here relates to allowing permits and issuing people to allowing them to use cast nets, which is a type of net that has weights around the side of it. You throw it like a frisbee to catch gizzard shad for bait in the Mississippi and St. Croix rivers. These folks want to use these bait. They're very fragile to fish flathead catfish. So Section 1 of the bill deals with that. Section 2 of the bill was a piece that was in our policy bill.
We are on the delete all, too. So
yes, I'm on the H.
When we're talking about the bill, we say delete all.
1406 DE2. Timestamp 11:37 a.m. That's the right version. Okay, perfect. So the second section, section two, deals with some technical changes to state law regarding U.S. Coast Guard changes on life jackets. I believe the committee has been received some letters of support dealing with this from the National Association of Remanufacturers Association. Section three of the bill deals with that as well. Section four deals with, it's a piece that came from the policy bill. It's a new boat that's been created. It's a wake surfing boat. So if you've ever seen these, they can cause a big, huge wake behind them, but you get on top of that wake and you're like surfing on the ocean. So there's no rope attached. You're actually surfing behind the boat caught in this wake. So what we're doing is trying to make sure that the requirements that are there for water skiing apply to this sport as well. So you would need to have a passenger or a mirror required to create a wake for a wake surfer. And also, now this is where the clarification came in, that there was a question from Representative Dill this afternoon in subdivision 2 on 4.28, prohibited night striking, skiing, or towing, and it's saying prohibited night activities, and the new language says on waters of this state for 1/2 hour after sunset to sunrise the following day, a person may not wake surf, operate a craft, creating a wake for a wake surfer, be towed by a watercraft, or operate a watercraft to a person on water skis. So that would prohibit that from happening at night, basically from the surfing at night. Like you can't water ski at night right now. We had a discussion about that a couple of years ago, and the legislature decided not to do it.
Representative Dill, do you have a comment?
No, I hate it when he's right.
Not very often, Mr. Chair. Section 5 of the bill gives us the authority, if you go back to the fact sheet here, allows us the authority to post at public accesses restrictions due to fish and wildlife disease outbreaks. So it would allow us to post restrictions on a WMA, for example, or an AMA if there was a disease outbreak there, something that we think we need to have in place. Section 6 is language that was brought to us through a U.S. Fish and Wildlife audit on our Dingell Johnson funds, where they were concerned that we may be out of compliance with our appropriations and how we work with Minute on our technology costs. So this language just clarifies that says, notwithstanding Section 16E145, appropriation for information and telecommunications from the Game and Fish Fund must be made to the commissioner. So they're very concerned about money's being diverted from the department, so the funds will come to the department and we'll transfer them, or we'll pay our bill to Minute with those funds. Section 7 of the bill deals with turkey hunting licenses, stating that you have to live on the land or qualify on the land of at least 40 acres. To provision clarifies that landowners or tenants must live on at least 40 acres in a turkey permit area to qualify for a separate process. Section 8 is Representative Dill's bill that the DNR has worked with him on.
Mr. Chair, are we going to stop as we go, or wait till we get done?
You know, I think it would be better if we talked to him as we go. So go ahead, Representative Klein.
Sure. The turkey license thing, you're not, are you reducing the acreage that you used to have, or is it the same? What's changing there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, the change is that the family members who live on the qualifying land, that you need to live on the qualifying land. Previously, the language used to say only persons who are owners or tenants of land who live on at least 40 acres land in the permit area and their family members. Now we're adding family members who live on the qualifying land.
Representative Cornish, I did call the National Wild Turkey Federation, and they are in support of this language.
Okay. I can still hunt in mine because I live on
it. You're good. Correct. You're good.
Mr. Chairman, moving forward, Section 8, as I mentioned, dealt with a Minnesota Veterans Home. This issue, as we discussed when it was laid over, started out very narrowly because we thought there's a limited number of beds in these facilities. Why not make the exemption statewide? So we appreciate Representative Dill bringing that issue to our attention. Section 9 deals with the feral swine and actually getting the state ahead of this feral swine issue. If you ever look at what other states have done, that the problems that these things can cause and the logarithmic population growth that they have, is rather alarming, and this actually makes it prohibits a person from hunting or trapping feral swine except as authorized by the commissioner. We don't want to make it, some states allow them to be taken without a permit. We don't want to incentivize people to take these and bring them in and release them. So we thought, let's just clamp it down and make sure that you can't do it. If we get to that point, we'll have to do that. We worked with the Department of Ag and Board of Animal Health on this language as well.
Commissioner, quite a few years ago, wasn't this issue before the legislature before? I can remember talking with you, and he was Representative Holston at the time, in his office about this very issue. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, we had some language initially, but it wasn't as far as this. We worked with the Board of Animal Health on some language, but it didn't quite meet the we never completed the last step of that, which is what this language does. It kind of closes the loop on these feral pigs from hopefully not getting into the state. Actually, there's some in Wisconsin right now, so it's kind of scary. We don't want to get them around here. Section 10, I believe, is an amendment that is coming in from from you, Mr. Chairman. Minnesota Deer Hunter language dealing with the hunter survey, hunter satisfaction survey. So I don't know if you want to speak to that or not.
I think it's a good provision.
Okay,
move on.
All right. Section 11 deals with an issue that came up. You may have heard in the news this past fall where a gentleman was attacked by a bear that he had shot with his bow at night while they were tracking it, and he was using a flashlight. And, you know, with the shiny laws that came into place prohibiting a person to use a ray to track an animal, it became apparent that we needed to amend this language. So this makes sure that a licensed bear hunter can use a flashlight basically to track or retrieve a wounded or dead bear while possessing the firearm, as long as they have their license, they're on foot and following the blood trail of a bear that was legally shot. So it just makes common sense for us to do that.
I think Representative Fabian had something to do.
We had talked to Representative Fabian about that issue as well. He was concerned about it, and it just makes perfect sense to do that. It's one of the issues we brought up at that time that the legislature was debating that bill. Section 12 clarifies that you can use radios basically to keep unprotected wild animals. You used to have to get a permit, so we're just saying that you can use radios to take unprotected wild animals. Section 13, I believe, is another representative deer bill allowing residents 84 or over to take a deer of either sex. Section 14 is language that the DNR has sought out for the bill that would make it against the law, basically, for a person to feed feed bears. It does not prohibit baiting bears for hunting. It gets at some of the situations that we've dealt with in parts of Representative Dill's district on feeding bears, but this would make sure that it's explicitly provided that you can't do that. Obviously, if you have a bird feeder and things like that, there's language that on the next page, number 3, feed is placed for agricultural livestock practices. Person is authorized to place food under scientific wildlife disease or wildlife damage permit. And then number 1 on 8.29, feed is placed solely for the purpose of attracting and feeding wild birds and small mammals, and placing feeding bird devices and structures is allowed. So we've tried to provide for a number of exemptions for common activities. Section 15 is some language we're seeking to allow us to do hazing, non-lethal hazing, for Canadian geese, basically. So you can see that does not apply to birds on the nests. Section 16 is the last segment related to permit to carry and hunting, I believe, in the statutes. We've solved the hunting piece, the deer hunting pieces, bull hunting pieces. This last one now will say that if you have a possession or permit to carry, you can carry your sidearm with you while you're turkey hunting in case you run into Turkeyzilla or something. So just wanted to clear that. It's been a gray area in statute for a long time. If you could have your sidearm with you, if you had a permit to carry or not, we have never cited anybody for that. But this just clarifies and makes sure that's explicitly legal. Section 17.
Line 919. Is there somebody from the DNR here, or could you answer what are the calibers legal for taking turkey? Because it says, while a field hunting turkeys, licensees may not have possession or control any firearm, bow and arrow, except those defined as legal for taking turkeys. But what if it's October turkey season and bear, woodcock, squirrel, rabbit, fox, coyote, everything is open in the October turkey season? So can you use all those weapons that you would use on those animals on turkeys?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that's what Sarah has. It's just shotguns, correct?
Number four shot.
Number four shot.
So you're going to run into a problem if you think. What about, can you take turkeys with bow and arrow in October season? Okay, I'll have to.
We can work on that, Representative Pettis. Let's get together with you. We'll work on that language. This bill does have another, a couple of stops before it gets to the floor. Section 17 establishes the beaver trapping season from October 26th to May 15th. The commission may establish open seasons. Section 18 relates to the gizzard shad casting nets for gizzard shad. Section 19 has one piece of mineral dealers language that we had that allows mineral dealers to have a designated employees as helpers to authorize to take, buy, and sell and transport minerals. They can be designated. They need to be designated on their license, and a copy of the license designating them as a helper must be contained with them. Section 20 is a rulemaking provision related to...
Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 19, mineral dealers. Related to that, is there anything going on internally in the department that might eventually get to the legislature regarding the harvesting of red-tail shiners on Winnie?
Spotted red-tail shiners.
Spotted red-tail shiners on Winnie during the period of May.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, we've been looking at that. Lake Winnebogoches has been designated as a water body infested with zebra mussels, though we have not found the smoking gun. We found veligers, but not zebra mussels attached to docks or anything like that. The issue that Representative Anzels brings up is that there's a lot of people who trap the spotted red-tail shiner for bait, and right now you have to stop when the water temperatures reach 54 degrees, I think, or something like that. We have done a risk assessment. I don't have the details of that at hand, but we'll circle back and talk about that with you.
That's fine.
So, okay.
We'll do that offline.
But I drive past that place every time.
I have not forgotten about that.
Either by Representative Purcell or other people around here. So that's dealing with that, Mr. Chairman. Section 20, rulemaking, lifting the spearing bans. This is the last piece of lakes that we'll bring back to remove the last lakes that are there with spearing bans that we've agreed to. I think it leaves
three left, two left, one left. That there's a spearing ban on statewide.
So this would remove how many now? 11 of the 12 lakes that are currently prohibited for spearing bans. It's done through rulemaking. Section 21 is some language that we're seeking out. It was in the policy bill. It's related to surface use ordinances. With the high water last year that came up, basically, our authority was only to grant local units of government to do emergency surface use ordinances for 5 days, and this would allow us to do up to 30 days. I think Representative Dill can recall the high water on Rainy Lake, and that lasted most of the spring and into the summer, and there was no wake conditions there for a lot longer period than that. We worked with a lot of local units of government to get those going this year, something we learned that a tool we needed to pick up. Section 22 deals with the Coast Guard life jacketing issues. Section 23, we've been contacted by the manufacturers of Conibear as a trademark infringement from our statutes, where we actually cite the term Conibear in statute. We've been trying to do this for several years. If we could get this done, the manufacturers would be grateful that we are going to body gripping rather than Conibear type traps. So that's what that is. And again, let me see. The repealers are 97A.475 deals with muskrat farm license that we don't no longer have. 97B.905 is a bond for full buyer licenses, and in 62-64-400 are the Northern Pike Experimental and Special Management Water Lakes.
Questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd let mine go for quite a while, so I thought I'd wait. I got a couple. Section 4, Commissioner Meyer or Enforcement wants to comment. Why are you taking away a half hour of water skiing time? And has there been problems? We're changing it from an hour after sunset to a half hour.
Is Trevin up Scanlon now for water skiing?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
I'm Stan Linnell, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Building and Water Safety Manager. Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara. Yes, this we meet regularly with groups of water safety officers, and we brought forth a variety of questions that we wanted to, that we thought might be important things to change and improve for water safety rules. And this is one where one of the officers thought that we really thought it was a problem that we're allowing water skiing and other towing tow devices an hour after sunset when it really is dark at that point. It's getting so dark that it's, if someone were to fall, it could lead to a safety issue. So that group looked at that and thought that it was one of the higher recommendations for making a safety improvement. Over 20 states across the nation have a cutoff at sunset, so we've been more liberal in Minnesota than many other states. Lake Minnetonka Conservation District currently has a rule a half hour after sunset, so this would make the rule consistent with the activity on that lake. So it's a safety consideration.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and as you know, we allow the discharge of firearm for a half hour after sunset, and that's a high-powered rifle in the woods where it's a lot darker. So I just want to be sure. I need to think this through a little bit because I know a lot of people do it in the evening, and especially if you get out in the middle of the lake, it's quite light out. So I know an hour after is longer than other things, but I just wanted to know if we've had trouble. And then my other question is, and I notice this a lot happens very early in the morning, people will water ski, and I notice you don't allow that until sunrise. And I'm curious, that doesn't follow that on our hunting again, we allow a half hour before sunrise. And is that a noise issue, or is that it must be noise, not safety?
That I can't answer the reason why that's been in place for a long period of time. Again, various states do it various ways. There are some that allow a half hour before sunrise. The noise issue certainly could be of concern.
Well, so current law is sunrise?
Sunrise, correct.
Sunrise to an hour after, Mr. Chair, and it's a long tradition in Minnesota to water ski early in the morning, very early in the morning, and serious water skiers ski very late at night because that's the best time. And so I just want to think that through. I think I may be okay with it. Mr. Chair, Section 13 is Representative Dill's deer any sex after 84 years of age. That's in here. I just would like to ask Representative Dill, or maybe the department, do we have any idea how many people that says?
Sure. 2,100.
Mr. Chair, about 2,100 is what we have right now.
Okay. And that'll include my dad this year. Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
2,101.
Right, because he turns. Okay. Mr. Chair, I had a couple things that DNR was supposed to be working on for me, and I'm wondering, is it going to change in rule or does it need to be in this bill? Currently, I believe it's... you have to go through two evenings when you buy your deer license before you can hunt. And I was under the understanding you'd be able to buy your deer license. We're going to change it so you can buy your deer license one day and hunt the next day.
After the season's open, you mean?
Correct. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, correct.
I need to check on that.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
That was resolved.
And where is it going? It's not going to...
Government operations.
Okay, it's going to government operations. Mr. Chair, I'd like the department, it was my understanding we were going to fix that because Representative Fabian and I both had constituents bring that up. Again, my constituents happen to be my 83-year-old father that, you know, and how you know you go to the holiday, Mr. Chair, and the holiday guy says, oh yeah, you don't have to worry, you can hunt tomorrow. And I said, Dad, I don't think so. opened the book after we left. I said, no, you're not going to be able to hunt for another day yet. So if I think that's non-controversial. The colonel told me he was supportive of it. So I think if it would be all right, rather make the bill go to my committee, I'd rather do it in government operations if it can. And I have one other one.
Mr. Chair, this Representative McNamara, you now I remember what we talked about in the fall. It was the youth hunt, the Northwest youth hunt, and it was an issue that we had. I think we can deal with it administratively on that piece. The issue you're talking about of your father buying a license and having to wait 24 hours after the season opens, or whoever that person.
I'm talking about the 500,000 deer hunters.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry. That's always been current law. The youth hunting, and I do go back and circle back with staff because I thought we had a solution. We will work with Representative McNamara, and if we need an amendment, have it drafted for government operation.
Well, Mr. Chair, time out. It's not always been current law. The old law that the chairman and I remember is if you didn't buy your license by the day before the season, you didn't get to hunt all season.
Right.
And so we changed that, and we have this. But today, I think, with the forensics and all that, I don't think it's fair to make somebody, and Representative Fabian, somebody came home, got a weekend leave from service, and then couldn't hunt. So if we could work on it. And then one more I had, it's been a problem for me, is Minnesota, I believe, is the only state in all our neighboring states that still require waterfowl to have a head and a wing. And the colonel told me he would fix that too. And is he fixing that in rule, or do we need to legislate that? Because I legislate things like three pheasants after December 1st if we do. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the latitude. And it can be, I apologize, I wasn't paying attention to this bill as much as I could.
Right. Commissioner, we can work on some of those things, and if we need amendments, please get them to me so we can fix it and go on.
Mr. Chair, we're working on it.
And particularly on the sale of the license, I'm interested in that now, too. We've got a list going. Representative Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 17, we got the season 26 October through May 15 for beaver trapping.
Is not from the DNR. That is my amendment in this bill.
Well, I say that was my question was, is May 15, could it be longer?
They've got it short now, and I'm extending it.
Well, that was my concern, that this is extending, may not be longer.
We've received several letters from county boards about beaver trapping and the shortness of the season. The main concern about the beaver season is the incidental catch of otter that is occurring, and sometimes otter with young of the year. So we're working at avoidance techniques and working with the Trappers Association on how to deal with that. So, and we're also very sympathetic of the damage to timber and damage to roads and damage to property. So, you know, we've done a lot on beaver trapping. We need to continue working on this. I think this is a piece that we'll work on as the bill progresses.
As long as Representative Wick brought it up, we have an amendment for this section, and if Ms. Taylor could report the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, it'd be on the DE2 amendment on line 9.26, delete 2, the one that's after October 26, and insert in the north zone, and from 9 a.m. on the Saturday nearest October 30th in the south zone period, then the season shall be open until, and then it would read until May 15th.
This is language that was worked out with Trappers Association.
And shoots, Mr. Chair. I need to find out what the department's position is, but yeah, that's the first we've heard of the amendment. So.
Okay.
It's a really good amendment.
It is a good amendment.
Mr. Chair. The discussion of extending the beaver season makes us Bemidji State alums a little nervous.
All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye. All opposed, motion fails, amendment is adopted. If you have any concerns with that, Commissioner Meyer, let me know before it goes
out. Mr. Chair, we'll be working with you on that.
Thank you. Who's next on the list, Representative Considine?
Just would like a brief explanation of line 6.5. What about people being not allowed people on their land for doing that? I don't quite understand it. I'm sorry, where were you? In the turkey hunting, line 6-5, persons who obtain a license in a separate selection must allow public turkey hunting on their land during that turkey season.
You realize this is current law. We're not changing law. This is current law.
No, I didn't realize that, but I still don't, I'd like to be able to understand it.
Okay. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, this section allows a landowner to receive a free license, basically. So you can see, starting on Section 7, it says a commissioner may conduct a separate selection for up to 20% of turkey licenses to be issued to any area. Only persons or tenants who live on 40 acres of the land are eligible. And then you can goes on, and then it says if you get this license, you obtain a license with a separate selection, must allow public turkey hunting on their land for that during that turkey season. I think, and that's what we did. I mean, when turkeys were first established, I mean, the turkey permit was a highly coveted thing to get. Turkey people were, I was going to say flocking, but it's probably not the right term. We're trying to get these licenses. You only need to apply for the lottery for the first couple of seasons, and you can buy them over the counter. I think in the next couple of years, you're going to be able to get turkey licenses over the counter, probably for all seasons if things keep going the way they are. So this language may need to be revisited at that time. It was something the landowner needed to do in order to get a free license. So
okay, that's all I really needed, though. Thanks.
Just
to this point, to clarify, Commissioner, you said they get a free license. They get in a preferential drawing.
No, I'm sorry. Yes, you're correct. Yep.
Representative Considine, when I first started in the legislature, there was only one area of the state that had turkeys. That was the extreme south, eastern part of the state. Now they're all over the state.
My concern is that my father-in-law lives south of town. Pretty routinely, people just decide to hunt on his land. So, yeah.
Representative Hertzog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, last year I visited with you, and there was going to be an effort to maybe fix a raccoon issue. And I don't recall if you said you could do that administratively or if we need to maybe tuck it into here, but especially in the seven county metro area, raccoons are just a huge problem. And I was hoping that we could get them off the protected list and they could be taken at any time, or at least significantly elongate the season.
Representative Hertzog, we can have a discussion now. We can certainly come by and visit with you in the next day or two and see if there's something that we can work out.
Sure.
And see if there's something that we can work out.
Sure. Whatever the chair permits.
Any other questions on the bill as amended, members? Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Good job. Anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Kimberly Dimmick.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your last name.
Dimmick. I own Dakota.
Can you spell that for the record so we can type it in?
Sure. D like in David, I-M-M-I-C-K.
Thank you.
And I didn't hear any talk on what I'm here to discuss, other than the fact that it was taken out of the Senate bill today, in which we are looking for.
And what is that issue?
It's regarding the discharge of firearms. Last year, we spent all our time in the Senate working with Bob Meyer at the DNR to help some of us who have livestock, who are being harassed by neighbors with gunfire. We worked out a deal with changing some things to the law that actually ended everybody's problems that were having these problems. And one of the big things that we changed at the time was that instead of you could not take a wild animal within 500 feet of a building occupied by human or livestock, we got it changed to you could not discharge a firearm within 500 feet of a building occupying human or livestock. Which is current law now, yes. And in discussing it with the DNR, making this change didn't affect hunters at all because they already couldn't hunt within the 500 feet, but it allowed us protection from the random gunfire which is being caused by neighbors harassing the livestock of farm owners.
and for me, my horses. I give riding lessons. My neighbor would purposely go out when I was in the middle of a riding lesson and start shooting his gun so it would spook my horse. I had kids coming off horses. And this is my concern about this bill. The other part was there's a couple up by Duluth who actually back in 2012 instated the law of 500 feet within from a corral, which was taken of a wild animal. We worked to get that changed to discharge too, so everybody's problems were solved. And we spoke with Mr. Meyer, and he agreed to put a committee together through this past year. So if there was any problems with making these changes, we could all work together and find out solutions that worked for everybody. And through the year, I contacted Bob Meyer a few times, asking, are we going to do a committee? And he said, I haven't had time. My last contact with him was December 8th. I asked if we were going to get a committee together. He said, no, we're not making any changes this year. And then 3 weeks ago, I got a phone call from him saying, our omnibus bill went in, there's changes, but we're taking them out since we didn't get a committee together. So my concerns are the wording is taken out of the Senate file now, but it's still in the House file, and I'd like to ask that it be voted on to be removed to for the law to stay as it was instated in 2014.
Original bill that was brought forward by the DNR did have that language in there, and we did not include it in our delete all bill either. So that language that
so it has been the changes they wanted to make have been removed.
Removed from the bill.
From the bill, okay, because the copy I have still has it.
That the delete all? Or?
No. Right. Okay, so I didn't get a copy of the delete all.
In the delete all amendment, it's not in there.
It has been removed there. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I'm confused because I've been in contact with Ms. Dimmick and she lives in my area and I just want to understand, is her concern being met or it is not?
Go ahead.
I'm hoping the language changes that they're proposing this year are not going to be allowed. So the law stays as it was put in place last year. So, and you're saying that what they propose has been removed in the law will stay.
House File 1406. This is the bill that you have that you're looking at. House File 1406.
This one.
That language has been removed.
Okay, because my copy still has it.
That's correct. If you looked at the delete all amendment, the DE2 amendment, the language is no longer in it.
This one.
Right.
Okay.
That's what you like.
That's what.
I just wanted to comment on this issue, especially on the developing edge where open discharge is still allowed. It's real problematic for a landowner in private land and private rights when an adjacent property is sold and somebody builds a house 10 feet from the property line. It really is almost like a taking of your privilege, taking of your land. And so I'm very conflicted about some of the rules with regard to who was there first, who gets to preserve their right.
Questions? Anyone else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to concur with my good friend from across the table here.
Any other questions, members? Anyone else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Okay, my name is Gary Lostiger. I'm here representing the Minnesota Trappers Association. And I only have comments on two of the sections. The first is Section 17. We do support that. The last 2 weeks of the season is probably the most important 2 weeks for the removal of beaver. The DNR has expressed some concerns with incidental take-up of otter. I think last year there were approximately 60,000 beaver trapped in the state of Minnesota. I think the DNR records for incidental take-up otter were 9 for the entire year. Not during that period of time, but during the entire year. The otter population is relatively robust right now. Trappers do a great deal to restrict that incidental take, and we'll continue to work with the DNR on that issue. But this is a date that keeps moving back and forth in recent times for reasons we don't know, and it's very important to remove the number of beaver. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage to road systems. And like last year, the spring was so late, there wouldn't have been the opportunity to trap beaver in the spring otherwise. The other has to do with section 23, the new conibear takes out the term conibear. And conibear is a brand name of body gripping traps. There's many, many different brand names. Conibear, John Conibear, invented the body gripping trap. It has become the Kleenex name, so to speak, of the trap. The concern that we have with taking that term out of it, body gripping trap, if you look at just that in its own definition, every trap, snare, foot trap, any other kind of trap, can't catch an animal other than by gripping its body. So by having the qualifier body gripper conibear, everybody understands exactly what kind of trap that they're talking about. The other types of traps are not otherwise defined anywhere in statute or rule. So our concern, I don't give advice to Onita Woodstring, which owns conibear. I don't think there's a trademark violation in any case to have it simply put in Minnesota state statute or rule. But we would be opposed to having that taken out of the statute because it just unqualifies what the term body grip trap. In addition to the Minnesota Trappers Association, I represent the National Trappers Association in states across the country, and that has been a big issue that has come up in other states when there's not a qualifier to what body grip trap means. All your laws for trapping instantly apply to that in a technical sense. And so we'd ask, we're happy to work with the DNR to come up with some language. It's not easy to describe a body gripping trap, which is why everyone uses conibear. So we oppose that section. I think that for another day that can get worked out, but we'd ask that that not be passed through this bill at this time. Thank you.
Questions? Representative McNamara.
To that point, thank you, Mr. Chair. This question may be for Ms. Taylor, but can't we in definition, just in one spot in definition, define body gripping trap as a body gripping conibear type trap? Does that get us in just as much trouble as listing it in 100 places?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that would be the same issue.
Okay.
Thank you. We need to not use the term.
And I, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I've spoken a number of times to counsel for Oneida Woodstream, who owns the trademark on conibear. Their concern is simply that a federal judge mentioned to them they need to clean up the use. There were other manufacturers of conibears that were calling, body grips that were calling their traps conibear in the marketplace. And so they took that advice from the judge very broadly and looked at, did a quick word search throughout statutes in the various states, and Minnesota just happened to be one. There are many states that use the term conibear. If you go out and search statutes throughout the country that have not been taken out, California has a very set standalone definition of body grip, which includes foot traps, snares, any kind of trap, and they do include everything, and they intend to include everything. By definition, every trap is a body grip trap. You can't catch an animal other than by through some part of its body.
Mr. Lesko, would you work with the DNR to come up with some other language in the meantime, in the next week or so we can get this taken care of?
Be glad to do so.
Okay.
Thank you.
With that, I would move that we delete Section 23 from the bill. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Members, the bill has to go to GovOps. I would renew my motion that House File 1406 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations as amended. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed and moved on. Members, we'll see you next week.